Brad Sesmat Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
Hey, it's Thursday and it's June, and Brad's off today, and there's two of us here to do the show. I'm Jeff Munn from Arizona State Women's Basketball, Phoenix Mercury, used to be with the D-backs. To my right, your left, Paula Bovin from azcentral.com. We probably should have bottled what we were talking about in the 10 minutes before we came on, because that too would have been a great show. But
I have to get something off my chest.
Can I
do this?
Absolutely.
Is about announcers, so I want your feedback.
Okay,
real quick, I know we got to set the table here, but there is a pet peeve of mine, and believe me, people call me on my mistakes all the time, but why are so many announcers prone to saying, and this is what I heard for the golf tournament. They were talking about somebody on the course, and the announcer says, he literally fell apart. If he literally fell apart, his limbs would be on the course,
yeah,
right? His hands would... It just bugs me, and I had to get that as a...
You know, there's little things that annoy me, too, like fingernails on a blackboard. I don't have an explanation as to why that term's used, and I'm thinking to myself, I've probably used it a time or
two.
I'll
call you if you do.
You know what my pet peeve is, and I've brought this up on the air, when these organizations, whether it's when they do interviews... Mm-hmm. They say, we're going to sit down with somebody. And I'm thinking, you can't interview them standing up?
Yeah.
I know, that's just...
That's petty, but it is, I hear you.
And yeah, we do, all of us, have a tendency to lean on certain phrases, and we're not even consciously aware that we're using them.
Sure.
It's just something, you know, if you forget something to say, use this phrase.
Right.
So.
Well, and as writers, we lean on things too, but the literally one, I'm just trying to... educate people that it drives me crazy. So, okay,
I understand. So, all right, let's set the table for this show. And the big news in sports is tonight, game 6 of the NBA Finals. I guess we'll find out just how important Draymond Green really is to the Golden State Warriors.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, he has one more opportunity for a flagrant, right? If he commits another flagrant, then he's...
Right.
Right? And so...
So he's got to watch it tonight.
He's got to watch it tonight.
So if you're Cleveland, are you trying to
bait
him into something?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I think that's a great strategy. And you saw the last game. They're testy. I mean, there's issues going on right now. So I think there's a great opportunity to do that. And for me, that's a part of his personality and part of the game I'm going to be watching right now.
Now, in scenarios like this, and for those who have not been paying any attention, the Warriors still lead the series 3-2, game
right.
6 tonight. The Cavs pulled off an unexpected win, even without Draymond Green in the Warriors lineup.
Right, right.
I still think the Cavs there is no pressure. Even though they're at home, it's game 6. I still don't think there's much pressure on them. They can go out if they do what they're capable of doing. They win the game, see in Oakland Sunday, and just, let her rip on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, but obviously they have to win. So I guess that's the pressure, right? I mean, they've got that expectation. For me, it's a Kyrie Irving Curry matchup, because Irving's just had his way with him. Of all the greatness we've seen with Curry, I thought Klay Thompson hasn't been able to really stop him. So that's another great matchup I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, and they both had tremendous nights in Game 5. On Monday. We will talk NBA draft later on with Mike DeCourcy, Sporting News College Basketball Insider, because the mock draft keeps jumping around. I mean, I'm looking at this today, and now this I go to NBADraft.net, and they've got the Suns taking Chris Dunn of Providence, who was kind of in the mix, but he's a guard. They're taking a guard at 4, and it's like this thing changes every day.
It's, and this is going to be so interesting to me because, as you mentioned, they're just guard heavy, right? They need a power forward, but they could certainly use a small forward, too. There's a lot of opportunities there, but there's also going to be some great guys at guard that are going to be available at that position. So this is huge. I just think they really, really, with that number 4, address that position, either power forward, small forward. I know they have someone at 13. They're probably better options at 13 as far as, value versus a spot. But I think we're going to learn a lot about this organization and this draft.
Yeah, and the great thing is the longer these finals go, the less time there is between the end of the finals and the draft next week. So it really works out well. I want to get Eric Sorensen in for a minute because I was not able to get to the show yesterday. But the story about this mega trade that Chad Ford of ESPN, I think, floated out there.
He did.
it doesn't sound. I looked at the particulars, and basically the Suns would get Kyrie Irving. You know,
I'll give you the
a
details.
Couple of restaurants
I have it right
in
here.
Cleveland and some other things.
I have it right here if you want
okay.
me to give it to you.
So, lay it on me.
Okay. Three-team deal involving the Suns, Knicks, and Cavaliers. The Knicks would send Carmelo Anthony and former son Robin Lopez to the Cavs. The Cavs would ship Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love, Mo Williams, and some guy named Sasha Khan to Phoenix. The Suns,
Khan!
Correct. The yeah. Suns would then trade Eric Bledsoe to Cleveland. Brandon Knight, Archie Goodwin, Alex Len, P.J. Tucker, and the 4th and 13th picks in next week's draft to the Knicks.
There is no way. There is no way they do that.
I was, you know, I was actually okay with it until you mentioned the two picks. I mean, that to me was the point because I would love to see Kyrie Irving here. I think and love, despite how we saw in his last game, yeah, that'd be great. But when you put all those players together and the draft picks
and the two
no.
picks,
no,
I'd be all for it because this team needs it. They need a do-over
for
they just,
that amount
they
of talent, though, do-over. Eric. If you're gonna send that many players and those two picks to New York. I want Walt Frazier and Bill Bradley in their prime coming back.
How about one of those draft picks I would do?
Okay.
Do the 4, you keep the 13, either way.
But you are getting two stars in their, yeah, two established stars in their early to mid-20s in Irving and Love.
Now, as I say, Brad discussed this yesterday on the show, and I apologize. I was involved in some meetings and couldn't get to the show.
You can always stream it online at any time.
That's true,
on
and
demand.
I was setting you up for that, by the way.
Thank you.
But what was his – he probably had the same reaction, like, come on, there's no way.
Too many stars involved
yeah.
for something like that. This isn't the olden days of, you know, with salaries and expiring contracts and draft picks not having the same value as they did back in the day. It's just hard to see a trade go down with 4 or 5
yeah.
mega stars changing teams.
And why would Cleveland want Carmelo at this stage?
Was Cleveland getting Carmelo?
Correct.
Okay. Well – yeah, I don't know.
I don't understand that because while I know Carmelo wants to play for a winner on list, I mean, demonstrated that he knows how to handle it playing
yeah.
for a winner.
We had Amin Elhassan on from ESPN, and he broke down the proposed trade, and he said, Carmelo Anthony is already focused on his life sort of after basketball, and being in the New York market has much greater value for someone to end their career with the Knicks and
yeah.
transition
mm-hmm.
into broadcasting or whatever than ending in Cleveland, even if there is a chance to possibly win an NBA title.
Well,
wow.
I'll believe that trade when I see it. And I'm on record as saying I hope I don't see it.
The one thing I'll say about it is a lot of those pieces, and I'll take – and Bledsoe was in that mix, right, Eric?
That one is
hard, but
– Bledsoe to Cleveland to play with LeBron. No
yeah,
shock.
Which makes sense. I mean, LeBron's been his biggest supporter. But, you know, I don't know where Archie is going to go. So, I mean, I think that one is expendable. And Brandon Knight, as much as I respect him and like his game, I can't say he's necessarily lived up to the hype either. But I guess it's that whole combination and the draft picks that is a little bit tough for this extreme makeover. But
well, assuming that this trade does not happen, Mike DiScorsi will discuss with us what he anticipates next week in the draft. There's a couple other things that I wanted to mention in this segment, and one of them involves media, and I know that you keep an eye on the media,
sure.
specifically through your Sunday column. The U.S. Open starts today. I think they're in their second rain suspension. But I wrote a thing yesterday for Sports360AZ.com. I think as big a story as maybe Dustin Johnson, Jordan Spieth, and maybe on the outside Phil Mickelson is mm-hmm. at Oakmont, Fox has got to get this right this time.
Oh, yeah.
They were such a disaster a year ago. And the thing I said in the column was they obviously have always had a lot of money to throw at things.
Right.
But when they've gone with something they're not used to doing, and I'll put up the Bowl Championship Series as example A, they just seem so out of their element that it never comes off well. As much as Tom Brenneman's a dear friend, and he did a terrific job as the lead announcer, but from a production standpoint, they never got the BCS.
What bug you most about how they covered it?
They didn't seem comfortable with college football. And I thought that their selection of talent, they used Jimmy Johnson, who obviously has a college coaching background.
Sure.
But he was part of their NFL coverage, and now for one night, they're going to stick him into the championship game. How much time had he had to really observe That first year was Ohio State against Florida.
Right.
Seriously. He's involved with the NFL. And I thought that they, you know, I wasn't comfortable with Charles Davis and Barry Alvarez mm-hmm. in the booth with Brenneman. You kept thinking, couldn't they have found somebody else? And it's the same thing with the U.S. Open. They put Greg Norman on the biggest golf event, and he'd never done TV before, and it flopped.
Of course.
Now they've gone with two experienced analysts in Paul Azinger and Curtis Strange. Joe Buck, this country, and I think, you know, I'm a big fan of Joe's dad, mm-hmm. always just idolized his dad, and I'm a great admirer of Joe's work, but he's getting to almost overexposure levels.
Well, yeah, and that overexposure, so many of those guys make it about themselves sometimes, and I sometimes feel like it's that case with him a little bit. That drives me crazy. You're right. I mean, when you are covering the event, the big event, you almost want to have people who have been there before, who have sat in that desk and experienced, because it's not just about sitting there and throwing out your opinions. It, obviously, if you have a track record of having done that, know what to expect, have context, that makes a huge difference.
Right. The other thing, quickly, and we'll get to the D-backs in baseball a little bit later on the show, just a quick thought before we go to break. The other thing that is always troublesome as a network, if your only experience in televising a sport is their primo event, it's like, I'm trying to think of an example, it's almost like Nickelodeon coming in to do the Super Bowl. They don't do anything else NFL. TBS a couple of years ago, I know they'd done the Braves for years.
Sure.
They were out of the baseball business, and then all of a sudden, here they are doing the League Championship Series, and it's like, what?
Right, golf is not baseball. Football is not basketball. They're all so unique.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree with you.
U.S. Open, Fox attitude. Mike DeCourcy from Sporting News will join us to talk the NBA draft. Paula Bobin, Jeff Munn, glad to have you with us on the Brant Sesmatch Show. On a Thursday, along with Paula Bobin, azcentral.com, and me, Jeff Munn, and for Brad Sesmat, I was about to promo your columns this week. You're on vacation.
That's right. But you can look at my old columns. Feel free to go to my old columns.
Sunday Notes column, it won't be in print, but you can find it online. Just go to archives. Which is, you know, I'm mad at Greg Hansen, the Star. His Sunday Notes column isn't available right now because he's on vacation. What's he doing taking a vacation?
The nerve, really.
Yeah. Mike DeCourcy of the Sporting News, college basketball insider. You also hear him as a studio analyst on the Big Ten Network, joins us. And we could talk about Game 6 tonight, but I know that you've been watching the developments with a week to go before the NBA draft, Mike, and it seems like give me your impressions of the way things are jumping around. It seems like after picks 1, 2, and 3, these mock drafts jump around almost daily. It just shuffles completely. Is that unusual?
I think it's a little bit more this year than it usually is, and I think some of that has to do with the fact that, honestly, it's not a great draft. And so different people maybe get the idea that they can find just the right gem in this draft by moving in a particular direction. Perhaps if you're Philadelphia, you look at your roster and you think, gosh, every time we get one of these picks, the best guy's a big guy, and they're kind of getting bogged down with that. And so maybe they're in the mood to trade one of the big guys they have or something like that. So I think that that's one of the reasons why you see so much movement in this draft. And also, when you have one-and-done players like Marquise Chris, who hasn't really played that much basketball. I mean, I think I looked at his stats the other day, averaged around 20 minutes a game as a freshman. So people don't know exactly how to evaluate him, whether or not there might be a lot more there than he showed as a freshman.
You know, Mike, it's going to be really interesting with the Suns. They have the 4, the 13, 28. They've got some options. They're obviously loaded at guard, you know, so we're hearing names like Bender as a possibility. Is there a guard in this draft, if he was available at 4, do you think they should take despite the loaded, how loaded they are at that position?
Well, you know, I think I don't think there's anyone in this draft other than Ben Simmons that you say, I absolutely have to have that guy. But there are guards who maybe could help the Suns. It depends on how really confident they feel about their perimeter shooting game and whether or not that's headed in the direction that they want. Because a Buddy Hield is a great shooter. He's really improved as a three-point shooter, and he's somebody that, you know, given the premium that's placed on shooting now, that might be something that he could really help them with. And Jamal Murray is a different kind of player because he's more of, although he can shoot off the catch, he's better at having the ball in his hands and making a shot. And so I think there are guys that are such good shooters that I think the Suns have to at least think about it. But some of that goes back again to how what do they think of Bender? Because his exposure to us in the U.S. is going to be limited because he's a European player, and so most of his play is over there anyway. And then it's compounded by the fact that in certain tournaments where he might have been visible to us, he hasn't been around. He hasn't competed for one reason or the other. So the read on Bender for a lot of us is limited.
Mike DeCourcy of the Sporting News and the Big Ten Network joining Paula Bovin and Jeff Munin on the Brad Sessmatch Show. The other thing, and I'm going to lean on your Big Ten knowledge, we see at one point initially about 3 weeks ago or a month ago, Denzel Valentine was kind of slotted into the lower portion of the first round, and at one point NBA mockdraft.net had him going to the Suns. Now he's risen to 18, a pick that is owned by Detroit. Now, given the local connection, if he's there at 18, I got to think, well, Detroit's going to take him because that's too good to pass up, right?
Well, not necessarily. I think you get yourself in trouble when you worry about things like that. The Pistons took Mateen Cleaves. Oh, gosh, I mean, it's almost a generation ago now. It doesn't seem like that long. But yeah, they took him in 2000, and it didn't work at all. I mean, Mateen, as a pro, he was a magnificent college player, but didn't work as a pro. And I'm not saying that that's what happens with Denzel. I'm just saying that you make your evaluation without worrying about emotion. And whether or not he fits for them, I like Denzel a lot as a player. I think he's going to be a good pro. He is not a dynamic athlete, but he excels as a shooter, a passer, and a rebounder. And those are three pretty important things in basketball. I think if you have a chance to have a guy like that on your team, that he can help you in some way. There's so many things he does at such a high level. For Denzel, the problem becomes, what position do you play him at? Do you play him as a small forward and try to run some things through him, or do you turn him over to being a point guard and play there? When Evan Turner came out of college and was a magnificent college player, I always thought that he just wasn't good enough at the other things, at shooting the basketball, to be anything but a point guard. And some teams have gone through some machinations trying to figure out what to do with him. I think Denzel does not have that problem because of his ability as a shooter. You can play him at multiple positions.
Mike, let me throw two names at you. Either I've heard them maybe, come up in discussions about the Suns, or guys I've seen a lot. The kid from Washington, Marquise Chris, I'm hearing his name come up a lot lately. And a guy I've seen a lot of, because I watch a lot of Gonzaga basketball, is Sabonis. I wonder your take on both those guys.
Well, I really like Sabonis as a basketball player. He doesn't elevate real well, and he's not real long. And that's what worries you a little bit about him. But he's really tough. He's really smart. He's really skilled. And so he's got some of the things that you want and doesn't have some of the others. If you're looking at him maybe a little bit deeper, one of the Suns' later picks rather than the first one, there are things that he can do to help you, but he does have those limitations. I think if I don't think this is beyond him. I think if he can develop from he's about a 12 to 14 foot shooter. If he can take that to 18 or beyond, I think at that point he becomes a significant NBA player. And I think if you can shoot it from 12 to 14, you can probably learn how to shoot it from deeper. And so I think that's the key for him. And Chris is an interesting guy again because he barely, I shouldn't say barely, but he played very limited as a college freshman compared to your typical one and done. I mean, a guy like like a Simmons who played as long as he could stand, you got a real read on him, or Brandon Ingram. But Marquise Chriss, who's such an incredible athlete, he only played about 18, 19 minutes a game on a team that didn't make the NCAAs. So there's the question, how much more is in there? And I think there's a lot. And I think that people are very excited about his potential, but they will have to wait longer, more than likely, for him to contribute than some of the other one-and-done guys.
Mike DeCourcy, the Sporting News and the Big Ten Network, joining us for a few moments to talk NBA draft along with Paula Bovin and Jeff Munn on the Brad Sesmatch Show. Okay, you mentioned right off the top that this is not a terribly deep draft. Given that, there's been a lot of talk about the Suns with three picks maybe dealing some of them to get a few more veterans in on the roster. Philadelphia owns three first-round picks. They've been rumored to be looking at the idea of dealing those two lower picks in the first round. But if it's not that great a draft, is there going to be that much interest among other teams for first-round picks in what is considered to be a lower-than-average draft?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that unless you – like if you get into a draft and you're a team – like San Antonio, which has a great scouting department, for instance, and there's somebody on the board that you like, and there's a team that's at that spot, and maybe you feel like you can get that guy. You might trade, but you might not trade a lot for him. So that becomes the lure for some of the established teams. But if you're a Philadelphia, you're already so young, and to get somebody else. You're obviously you're not going to trade the one pick unless you're just swapping spots to two or something like that. But you're not going to trade that pick. But the multiple picks, if you can get a veteran that might be able to add some stability to your team, I think absolutely that would be appealing for them and to a slightly lesser extent for the Suns.
You know, you talked, Mike, about Bender, and a lot of people are putting him at that number four spot in their mock drafts for the Suns. Do you think that's too big of a risk? Do you think that makes sense, or where do you stand on him? I know, like you said, there's still a lot of unknowns because of where he plays.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen more of him in some of the big tournaments, but he's really skilled. He's so big and he's so skilled. And you look at you don't want to get caught up in the idea. Well, Porzingis was this, so therefore he's that.
Right.
Because you wind up in the same spot a year ago when Porzingis was taken and everybody was comparing to, say, Skeetishvili from a decade ago. You just have to evaluate each player on his individual ability. And Bender is really skilled. I wonder a little bit about his toughness. I wonder about, how hard he'll go for 82 games. Those are things that I worry about with him. But in terms of his skill and his size, a good athleticism, I think he's got a lot of good qualities. And given that the draft itself is not overwhelmingly gifted, it's hard to go wrong with a guy that has the package that he does.
Mike DeCourcy of the Sporting News with us. We also should get a thought from you about Game 6 tonight between the Cavs and the Warriors. Paul and I were talking in the first segment. To me, even though it is, they're at an elimination point, I still feel like there's not much for the Cavs have nothing to lose. I mean, they managed to get out of Oakland with a win in Game 5, and obviously Draymond Green didn't play. But I think they can go out and play tonight loose, relaxed, and they've got nothing to lose. Am I right?
Well, I think to an extent, but you still look at it as if you lose, you're done, and you don't win the championship. So I think there's a lot on the line in that sense. But I think that the problem with playing loose is, LeBron in Game 4, when it was really there for the taking, didn't play loose. He didn't play like himself and was much better in Game 5 when it looked like the series was over. Now, obviously, some of that is the absence of Green, but not all of it. I mean, you could tell, and both Van Gundy and Mark Jackson commented on this as they were commentating on the game, you could see his eyes were looking to the side and not straight ahead to the rim a lot of times when he was bringing the ball into the offense. And when his eyes are looking to the side, that means he's trying to set up his teammates, and it's just not when he's at his best, and that's not when they're at their best. He has to be attacking, and then if all avenues are shut off once he gets deep, then at that point, try to make a play. That's what has to happen for Cleveland to be at their best. You saw that in Game 3. You certainly saw that in Game 5. I don't think there's any question that if LeBron James is not a significant force, and what the number attached to that is, it's not about, you know, whether he gets 25 or 30 or 41 again. It's about how he plays and how he forces Golden State to deal with that.
Well, Mike, we appreciate the time. Obviously, this mock draft stuff is probably going to jump around about 8 or 9 more times before yeah. next week. So we appreciate it, and hopefully it'll come out pretty much the way we think it's going to come out. Thanks for being with us.
All right. Thanks, Jeff and Paula. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Mike DeCourcy, the Sporting News. By the way, before we go to a break, the other thing about Game 6 tonight,
mm-hmm.
ESPN did a really classy thing. They're putting Craig Sager on tonight to work the
sidelines.
That
is awesome. I thought that was great. He had never done the finals before,
yeah.
right? This is the first time.
And you know the whole Craig Sager story. It's a tremendous thing. Speaking of ESPN, and we also have Bill Gutekunst on today for his weekly visit about the movies. But coming up in our next segment, we're going to discuss something I really didn't think I would get hooked into, and I got hooked in completely. OJ, Made in America. We'll talk about it, and for good reason, coming up next on the Brad Sesmet Show. Jeff Munn and Paula Bovin from Paula, of course, is with azcentral.com. And you see this program on azcentral.com. If you weren't on vacation, what would you be writing about this week?
Oh, gosh. I'm so checked out. I haven't thought about it. You know, some of the things maybe we talked about, maybe what we're about to talk about, this OJ thing, because I've been consumed by that just when I'm not watching it, thinking about it.
OJ Made in America, and Eric, enlighten me. I don't think they're running a segment of it tonight because of the NBA Finals.
That is correct. That is correct.
But they've gone three.
There were three out of the five
have made the air.
Correct.
Now, just so that everybody understands, I've seen all five. They're online at Watch ESPN, and I've decided to watch all five of them. Eric and Paula have seen the over-the-air, which means they've seen 1, 2, and 3. So I'm not going to give away anything out of 4 and 5 because I don't want to spoil it. But let me say, first of all, you and I both were working in the media. You were in Los Angeles at the time all this unfolded. And I just start by saying when I heard – I have not watched the miniseries – I heard they were going to do this film, my first reaction was, I'm not spending 10 seconds watching this.
Right.
And then I watched it. And then I got so hooked on it after watching a rerun of part one, and it said at the crawl at the bottom, parts 2 through 5 are available online. I thought, I'm going and I'm watching right now.
Right.
I just got immediately hooked in.
Yeah. I lived in L.A. at the time, and in fact, the day of the car chase, I had flown back from Hawaii to Los Angeles. I had just finished my honeymoon. So we're in Hawaii on my honeymoon, hearing about the murder. I think I'm trying to remember the timing or the death. And then the car chase is happening. I'm standing in LAX and we're trying to, you know, find a TV or something to see it. It was incredible. So I certainly have very vivid memories. Got married not too far from, you know, where it happened.
The thing to me, and first of all, I will tell you this, without giving away anything in parts 4 or 5, when ESPN says this is the best 30 for 30 they've ever done, go to the bank. It is, we'll just stick with parts 1 through 3 because you and Eric have seen those parts. Riveting television.
It is, and this, a couple things stand out to me, and let me just say, just I saw 1 and 2, I have not seen 3. I haven't recorded, but that's okay. I read the highlights of it, but these are the things that stand out to me. One, the access, the video, they got things I'd never seen or heard about. And the people they found to interview, that was amazing. But the moment when he's on the golf course and he's cheating, I don't know if you remember this part of it, and it's in part 2.
Yes.
The sort of, I think it was 2, the entitlement of that guy. I mean, just that he thought that was okay and never thought it wasn't okay, just told me so much about him. I don't know why that scene stood out to me, but it did.
Now, again, you talk about access. I don't want to spoil it for you either, but in part three, and a lot of people have seen part three.
Yeah, no, go ahead and talk
about
that.
You will hear things. I keep forgetting the name of the detective. Tom, I can't remember his last name.
I don't remember either.
Well, it's going to drive me nuts. There is tape, and on the one hand, they tape everything in a police department. There is a tape of a discussion between an LAPD detective and OJ while he's riding in the Bronco with a gun to his head.
Tom Lang, by the
Tom
way.
Tom Lang, thank
yeah,
you.
You.
Gosh,
go.
I was going to lay awake
Google.
At night.
You're the best.
Thank you. That conversation mm-hmm. alone was worth seeing part three. Just that little phone conversation between Tom Lang and OJ while he's got a gun to his head in the Bronco. And the other thing I think that is significant, and I've asked myself this question all the way through, why are we still fascinated with this? And I think one of the explanations is it was this country's first real step into the world of TV, tabloid
right.
media. I don't say journalism or reality TV. I mean, just that Bronco chase, there was the real possibility all through that drive that he was going to commit suicide. And you had to watch it because you thought, I got to see it happen if it occurs. And that to me is one of the reasons why I understood it when it was happening,
sure.
why the country's fascinated. I have a hard time at times trying to figure out why we're still fascinated with it 22 years later.
Well, and I think that this series answers some of that question because it is a story not only of OJ, but of race and celebrity. And I love how the sort of juxtaposition of what was happening in L.A. at the time, the tensions. I was after the riots following after the Rodney King verdict, I was in a balcony in Burbank and I could see down the city and I could just see it in flames. I mean, it was such a powerful time, and it wasn't just, you know, what was happening at the backdrop of what was going on with OJ, I think is just explains a lot of that too. And just unbelievable. I mean, you know, the revelation that he stole, you know, Al Cowling's is that his name? Yeah,
his Al best, Cowlings.
Cowlings' girlfriend.
Right.
In high school. I mean, it started, it was already starting then
yeah.
that he thought he could get away with things, and he did.
Now, one of the things, and this may have come up, I don't remember what part this came up, but I'm reading a story today. Roy Firestone, who used to do a show on ESPN called Sports Look, did an interview with OJ, and I want to say it was just after 1990, around the time that, just months after, there was an incident in which Nicole Brown Simpson called the police, and she had, I mean, look, I'm just going to say it, she had been beaten by O.J. Simpson. They'd had an argument, and there was physical abuse involved. And Firestone, he softballed questions to O.J. in that interview, and he is now saying, it haunts me to this day. Now, I'm going to say, first of all, and Paul and I remember that show, softball interviews by Roy Firestone was a daily occurrence on that show.
Absolutely.
He didn't pin anybody down. And his successor, Chris Myers, did have OJ on one day, and he did ask him some really tough questions. But Firestone, I had forgotten. I didn't even know if Firestone was still alive.
Yeah,
I don't know what he's doing
now.
He's
doing, like, the Vegas kind of circuit, like, you know, more entertainment show.
Well, he was always kind of a pseudo impressionist.
Right.
He could do mock impressions of people.
Yeah, he was a comedian and entertainer,
yeah.
and this was sort of that other side of it. Yeah, if you haven't seen that part of the show, this interview with Firestone and OJ is awful, and it's really uncomfortable to watch because he, you know, kind of defends this abuse and his image and everything else.
And again, not to interject, but we don't know the backstory. You know how it is sometimes when a controversial star goes on one of these mm-hmm. magazine or platform shows, it's always, we're going to meet, we're going to talk topics, we're going to talk
sure.
what you're going to ask, how you're going to ask it, how's OJ going to answer it. I mean, it's
right.
almost, you could tell that was beyond scripted. And I know Roy Firestone wasn't really a hard-hitting, edgy journalist like you guys mentioned. But I'd love to know how that all came about. Firestone's people reaching out to OJ's people. This is how it's going to be. This is what you're going to ask him.
I'm sure
they had what he's going to wear, blah, blah, blah. All the way down to the B-roll, everything. So,
well, to his credit, it looks like in this story, the headline is Firestone said that interview still haunts him. So he clearly...
Easy to say that now.
Yeah, but I respect that he's talking because he could not have even... He could have said no to interviews. I'm glad he's saying... That and
I agree with you, Paula. The coverage and the access and the footage. I mean, just the
it's unreal.
The ground level things that we've never seen from the Bronco pulling into OJ's house to the people lining up. I mean, on the overpasses as the Bronco went under the overpasses, just dozens upon dozens of people. And I never knew until I watched episode 3 that OJ had $10,000 cash and a passport.
A passport. I knew that.
I didn't know that. I'm sure that that wasn't a big secret. I had just forgotten it in all the melee of it.
Part 4, and again, I'm not going to give away things. I've seen it, and maybe many of you who are watching today have seen it online, will deal specifically. It's pretty much all about the trial. And I learned things about that trial at either, and I was a news anchor at KTAR at the time, and we carried the trial every day. And for good reason, because our ratings kind of went through the ceiling when we did. And I always made the joke that if we were doing a lot of phone-in talk shows at that time, and I always said if the phones got slow, just go on and say, do you know who really did it? You know, in relation to OJ, and it'd be like, should Pete Rose belong in the Hall of Fame? You just say it and kaboom,
right.
The phones explode. And Saturday night at midnight, some guy would call the station and say, I know how OJ did it. My point being that I thought I knew everything about that trial, and you will hear things in part 4 that either I just didn't pay attention to, or it was also, I'll say this, it was also a great education to the American people about how the legal system works. And I say it in this respect. Do I believe O.J. Simpson committed those murders? Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. But did the system work the way it's crafted? In a way, yes, because the defense attorneys they're empowered, or it's their responsibility to, and I'm using the legal term, create a reasonable doubt.
Right.
Their job was not to prove O.J. Simpson did not commit the murders. Their job was to put a reasonable doubt in the jury's mind, and they did.
They did. Absolutely, they did. And, you know, you're right about the whole legal system and how it shed this light on it and how these people in some ways became celebrities. You know, it was the first Kardashian before the Kardashian
right.
show. You know, obviously he had a friendship with the Simpsons before then. But Lance Ito, that guy probably
Marsha Clark,
all the Chris Darden, all those names.
Yeah.
Still hear them.
It's amazing. We got to go to a break. Bill Gutekunst will talk movies, Finding Dora, Central Intelligence. And he's got some thoughts on OJ Made in America. And I said we mentioned the D-backs. They did lose to the Dodgers yesterday. Okay, I've mentioned it. We're moving on. More of the Brad Sesmatch Show. Paula Bovin, Jeff Munn in on Thursday. And Paula Bovin is one of his colleagues at AC Central. And since Paula's on vacation, she's got a lot of time to go to the movies. Do you have a lot of time to go to the movies?
I do, but I haven't. I don't know why I haven't been out. There hasn't been a lot out I've wanted to see lately.
Okay. So. Well, Bill might have some suggestions for you because there are 3 films that are coming out this week. And we'll start, Bill, with Finding Dory. A lot of times these animated films, the sequel, the follow-up, I guess it's like any other sequel. It's kind of a roll of the dice. But everything I've heard, and granted, it's the reviews and trailers, they're all saying, wow, this thing knocks it out of the park. What was your impression of Finding Dory?
Yeah, it's really good. It's I know what you're talking about. I mean, Pixar is not immune to the bad sequel. I think in my review, I said that Cars 2 is sort of like the Godfather 3 of the Pixar universe. But the... this one's really good. It just the shifts the story some. Obviously, as you would guess from the title, it's more Ellen DeGeneres' movie than Albert Brooks. And Albert Brooks is great as Marlon the Clown. Albert Brooks is always great. But she's,
they do stuff with the character, and it's interesting. Like they treat her, because we see her, we meet her when she's like a little baby fish or whatever, and I guess she's always had this short-term memory problem, and they treat it like a child with a disability. Like her parents kind of teach her how to learn to live with it. And, you know, maybe that's reading too much into a cartoon or something, but I don't think so, because I think Pixar is generally known for being pretty smart. But it's also, it's really funny.
How about Central Intelligence, Bill? That's one that's interested me.
You go into all this stuff open-minded, right?
Oh, dear. Okay.
No. I go into everything open-minded. But there is a part of my brain that says The Rock and Kevin Hart in a thing where The Rock is a CIA agent.
Yeah, I hear you.
And it's like, this thing is going to be awful. And it wasn't awful. And the reason it was not is the two of them. They're really good together. And they're not like what you call like great actors, but they're really sort of good at what they do. And there's something to me that's always admirable about, and who knows, they may go home and kick their dogs or something, but they seem like a couple of guys who are sort of comfortable with who they are, comfortable in their own skin. And I think there's something sort of comforting about watching that, you know, and they're funny, you know, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's really, the plot is really stupid, but you're not there for the plot. You're there to see if these guys are going to make you laugh. And they did. There were a couple of, and then The Rock is, it turns out, he sort of gets Kevin Hart to be the straight man. At one point, he tells Kevin Hart, they're going to a reunion or something, I can't remember when it was, but he says, no, you look good, kind of like a black Will Smith.
That's good.
And we're talking with Bill Gutekunst of AZ Central, his weekly visit, talking about movies and other culture-type things, which we will get to. Just a fair warning, Bill. I want to go back to one thing about Finding Dory, and you mentioned Ellen DeGeneres and how she kind of carries this film. I have my favorite animated film is Up. And I don't know if that's a Pixar film. There's two or three studios. And I felt when I saw Up that Edward Asner deserved an Academy Award. Is there still a stigma in Hollywood about giving awards to actors who portray roles in animated films?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think to my knowledge, it's never been done.
Great question.
But when you think about it, it could be. There was talk, this doesn't really count as animated, but there's a movie called, what was it called? It was called Her, I believe. And Joaquin Phoenix was set in the near future. He had this sort of like futuristic iPod-like thing. But it was a person. It had a voice and stuff, and it would talk to you. It was like artificial intelligence. And Scarlett Johansson was the voice. And there was a lot of talk about her getting a nomination for that, but it didn't happen. I think there's kind of a stigma against comedy in general that almost never gets nominated for an Oscar. And certainly, I think the last animated film to get nominated for Best Picture might have been Beauty and the Beast. I can't remember. That didn't happen very often. But and maybe Up did. I don't know. I don't remember. Obviously, I mean, it didn't win. But
Up got some awards, but on the technical side. Occurred to me about, you know, Asner should have gotten, should have gotten an Academy Award. But what do I know?
There's
movies.
No rule against it. There's no prohibition against it. I mean, I don't
True.
Think, you know, they could.
Exactly.
It's just...
What,
maybe she'll do it.
Maybe she will. All right. I hope you like this movie because I want to see it because I like the subject matter and Thomas Wolfe. I like the cast a lot. I think it's Jude Law and Colin Firth, if I'm not mistaken. Genius, did you see it? Am I going to be disappointed? Or?
I think you are.
Oh, great.
Part of it because, part of it is, as you say, the cast. An interesting thing about the cast. Okay, the movie is about Maxwell Perkins, who's a legendary editor. I was an English major, so I was really psyched to see this. Maxwell Perkins is this famous editor. His writers included Thomas Wolfe, who the film is mostly about, Ernest Hemingway, who shows up, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who shows up. Thomas Wolfe is famous, or maybe even infamous, for turning in just like hundreds of thousands of pages. In one part of the movie, they bring it in wheelbarrows. And Maxwell Perkins kind of has to shape it and trim all this stuff, and it takes forever. Now there's sort of this thinking that maybe it should have been presented the way it was originally. Maybe it was better. I don't know. But, I mean, I've read his books, and they were plenty long enough for me the way they were. But it's just they come off almost cliched. Like Jude Law is a good actor, but he is way over the top in this thing. I mean, he's a Thomas Wolfe is from North Carolina. He's one of these guys. He's obviously a word person, but he talked a lot too. And it's too much. He just goes too far. And Firth, who's also a great actor, is so buttoned down. It's like you want to shake him by the lapels and say, "Hey, man, wake up!" And then like. Also, take the hat off. He only takes the hat off inside or outside at dinner or anywhere else at the very end of the movie. But it's an interesting thing about the movie is the cast includes Colin Firth, Jude Law, Guy Pearce, Nicole Kidman. And the sort of interesting thing about this most American story is that none of them are American.
It is interesting.
Everybody's either British or Australian. And I don't know if they should. The director, I talked to the director, actually, and he's British. He's known for the British stage and all this stuff. And, you kind of work with whoever makes the movie. But it's just sort of interesting that, like, it doesn't matter. They're actors. I mean, I think I put in my review, please also remember that Mr. Spock is not actually from Vulcan or whatever. They are actors, and they're able to, portray different people than who they really are. But it's just kind of curious and kind of weird. I thought that there's no American that could play any of these roles.
That is interesting.
Well, if Spock's not from Vulcan, well, the character's from Vulcan. I was going to say you might want to tell Sheldon Cooper that Spock's not from Vulcan, but that's another story for another day.
Now, I should have said spoiler alert.
Yeah, I get one curveball question with Bill every time I do this show, so I'm going to go ahead and do it right here. Who on earth thought Alec Baldwin would be a good fit to host Match Game? What are thinking?
I had that same thought, but...
And I'll take 10 seconds to explain why, Bill. I'm sorry I didn't interrupt. On celebrity game shows where comedy's involved, the host has to be a straight man. Peter Marshall made Hollywood Squares work for 13 years because all he did was tee it up for Paul Lynn, Charlie Weaver, Wally Cox, George Gobel. Baldwin's not a tee-it-up guy. He wants to hit the ball. So I'm thinking, why did they do this?
I don't know. I mean, he's a big name. I mean, he's certainly getting some attention for doing it. They're great jobs. I mean, you work you work about a week every month taping a whole bunch of shows, and you get paid a ton. And so he I can understand why he did it, why they wanted him. I don't know. It's not like he's like this struggling actor who, he's not on like Dancing with the Stars or something. I mean, he's just a curious pick for it.
Tom Bergeron would have been great. He did Hollywood Squares. He would have been perfect. And I'm going to let Paula get a question in, but Michael Strahan on the $100,000 pyramid, I don't even want to go there. Michael, you're a great guy, but you're not Dick Clark.
I know. When did that happen?
No, he's doing it. He's hosting that show.
He's doing everything.
I know. But apparently he's not getting along with Kelly Ripa. Well, that's another.
And it's interesting that these game shows are kind of coming back now. They're resurrecting a lot of them.
Yeah.
And those were sort of the one type of reality TV, I think, back in the day. What they have going on right now, Bill, I don't know if you've been watching the OJ Made in America. Jeff and I have just been raving about it, the access, the interviews. Do your gut reaction if you've been watching it about the series?
I haven't been watching it, but my TV critic friends who have and written about it love it. And I remember one of my friends wrote that she said, I finally sat down to watch it and review it. I thought it cannot live up to this hype. And she said, it absolutely does. And then some. Despite or maybe because of the tragedy involved kind of all the way around, it's one of the great American stories of the late 20th century or late 20th century. Earlier this year, the FX series, the it wasn't, the sort of lightly fictionalized one, the miniseries, that was great. I mean, it's a story that can't go wrong. Famous, although I think that one of the things that is true is, and why I think that this series is kind of good and kind of important, a lot of people today, to my kids, O.J. Simpson, if he means anything at all, he's just this guy that shows up occasionally because he's in prison or he killed somebody.
Right.
And there's no context of how great a football player he was. And,
terribly
and sort,
ironic.
Sort of what a big celebrity he was.
Yeah, it's ironic. Bill, we've run out of time. We could do hours and hours on stuff, but ponder that until next week about Alec Baldwin hosting Match Game. It's an absolute disgrace.
Deep thoughts with Jeff Murray.
That's right. Goody, appreciate it. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you.
You got it. By the way, nice transition from game shows
how about
to OJ.
Yeah, that I'm
is
learning.
The word. That's solid.
I know. I was wondering how the heck I was going to get from one subject
to another.
I
was really impressed with that.
Thanks, Jeff.
Man,
a lot coming from
it's good stuff. Hey, there's lots of good stuff on this website, sports360az.com. There's a lot of good stuff at azcentral.com. Even when Paul is on vacation, you can still find a lot of good stuff to read at azcentral.com. So visit both sites. You'll get always get the latest in local sports in particular. And this is the Brad Sesmatch Show on a Thursday, and we're awfully glad that you checked us out today.